Welcome to Public International Law in a Nutshell, the CIS podcast series. Today's topic, space law.
From the very beginning of human history, the stars have intrigued us. They have sparked myths and legends. They raised speculations and dreams of where we're coming from and where we're going. At the dawn of space age, when the first satellite Sputnik was launched into space in 1957, the world was holding its breath. At the latest, since Neil Armstrong took his famous small step in 1969 and became the first man to walk on the moon, imaginations have blossomed that the possibilities outer space offers to humankind could be as infinite as itself.
But as endless as space seems, its resources within our reach are limited. The moon offers no room for an infinite number of research stations, the orbit not for an infinite number of satellites. This is why legal agreements were needed to protect outer space and to facilitate its use and discovery for the benefit and in the interests of all mankind.
Now, in the 21st century, space has indeed become the ultimate frontier for commerce, technology, and national security. Moreover, space is no longer accessible only to a handful of spacefaring states. Private actors are also becoming increasingly active in space, not only for research purposes, but also for commercial ones.
Probably you've already heard of Elon Musk and one of his most thrilling and futuristic companies, SpaceX, based in the United States. In 2015, SpaceX started to work on a project called Starlink, which aims to provide accessible, reliable, and cheaper high-speed internet, even in the most remote places on Earth, by sending thousands of satellites into the low Earth orbit.
This poses two fundamental questions. Whether international space law is adequate to, first, deal with private space activities like SpaceX's, and second, to balance valid private interests with the general public ones in outer space.
In this podcast, we would like to present you the basic principles and general concepts of space law. We will also dive into current developments and challenges concerning space law and concentrate especially on the problem of space debris.
We are Lydia Vosberg
and Vivienne Kobel,
and we would like to invite you to discover with us whether SpaceX's activities, especially in regard to Starlink, are in accordance with the general concepts and principles of international space law. This means, are they legal? And later on, we would like to discuss with you how they could be evaluated in the light of current developments in outer space. So the question will be, are they legitimate?
So let us begin with the central concepts and principles of space law that regulates human activities in outer space.
Here, the first question we should ask ourselves is, what is actually meant by outer space?
This is not clearly defined in space legislation and literature. Therefore, we will stick to a definition by Professor Stefan Hober, one of our interview partners with whom we will speak later. For outer space in the legal sense, comprising the solar system, he proposes the start at an altitude of at least 110 kilometers above sea level.
In comparison, it is undisputed that outer space in the broader sense includes the celestial bodies as well. That is, for example, the Earth, Moon, and the planets.
And since outer space, unlike the airspace, is an international legal common space, similar to the high seas, the ocean floor, or the Antarctic, the international relations in this regard fall within the regulatory sphere of international law.
Right. Space law, consisting of the sum of legal norms that relate to the exploration and use of outer space, can be designated as a set of lex specialis rules. But how did they develop?
A technical innovation was originally the beginning of the era of space law. In 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1 into outer space, wishing to avoid the extension of present national rivalries into this field and recognizing the great importance of international cooperation in the study and utilization of outer space for peaceful purposes. The United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Use of Outer Space was established as an ad hoc committee and merged into a permanent body in 1959.
Exactly. All international space legislation is prepared in the legal subcommittee of UNCOPIUS. Thereby, decisions are reached by consensus.
While this method of decision-making proved to be effective in the past in bringing about general agreement on core principles of space law, with growing membership, diversity in national interest, and increasing economic value of outer space, consensus was no longer easy to achieve. This is also represented by at least three different phases of space lawmaking.
During the first phase between 1959 and 1979, the so-called Corpus Juris Spatialis, that means the five major UN space law treaties, came into being. The most important ones for our podcast are namely the 1967 Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and Other Celestial Bodies, or Outer Space Treaty, OST for short. Also, we have the Outer Space Liability Convention of 1972 and the Moon Agreement of 1979.
During the second and third phase, starting in the 1980s, respectively the late 1990s, only non-binding UN General Assembly resolutions and declarations were adopted. All right, after having briefly talked about the development and some sources of space law, let's get to the core concepts embodied in them.
The basic legal patterns are derived from the provisions of the Outer Space Treaty, which we will now take to hand and which, in large parts, can be characterized as customary international law. The aim of international space law in general is to establish outer space as res communis omnium, an international common space, as we have said before. According to Article 2 OST and Article 11 of the Moon Agreement, neither outer space nor the celestial bodies are subject to national claims of appropriation.
This so-called non-appropriation principle is, one could say, the cardinal rule for the legal regime of outer space.
Also, this principle is part of jus cogens. Nevertheless, details of Article 2 OST are disputed. For example, does the prohibition of appropriation also include the commercial use of a certain territory?
You could certainly say that if an area is exclusively used by one state or private person, this would be contrary to the legal status of outer space as an international common. So the non-appropriation principle is a limitation to the freedom of exploration and use of outer space, which itself is another core principle laid down in Article 1 OST.
Exactly. It can be argued that exploration is a preliminary stage of later use, and that use encompasses both commercial and non-commercial activities. All of those activities, however, have to be peaceful, as stipulated in Article 4 of the OST, and should not harm the environment.
And the exploration and use of outer space shall be carried out for the benefit and in the interest of all countries, irrespective of their degree of economic or scientific development, and shall be the province of all mankind, as stipulated in Article 1 OST.
This would be a very unspecific limitation on the freedom of use, wouldn't it?
Yes, definitely. And as we know that in international law, there's the so-called Lotus Principle, a presumption in favor of the freedom of states. This community clause is not interpreted in the literature in a way that it stipulates a concrete limitation, but in a way that the interests of the international community should be taken into consideration.
Talking of states, it has been a long time since they were the only players in outer space. So what about private, respective commercial activities? Are the principles we have just talked about also applicable to Elon Musk's Starlink project and the thousands of satellites he plans to launch into the LEO?
Before we answer these questions step by step, I think we should take a second to explain what the abbreviation LEO means that you've just mentioned.
Of course. LEO designates the low Earth orbit at a heat of 200 to 1,200 kilometers, which is far lower than the geostationary orbit that might ring a bell. The GEO is the orbit preferred for commercial telecommunication satellites.
All right, so back to the question. Are private activities in outer space foreseen in international space law at all?
Indeed, they are. Article 6 OST expressly allows them by stating that states parties to the treaty shall bear international responsibility for national activities in outer space, whether such activities are carried on by governmental agencies or by non-governmental entities. This means that any private activity is attributable to the launching state. This is why, as stated in Article 6 OST, the activities of, for example, SpaceX shall require authorization and continuing supervision by the appropriate state party to the treaty, as we have here the USA.
Right, and authorization here means the process of licensing that ensures the criteria for the launch of a space object are met.
The state also retains jurisdiction and control over any object on its national registry according to the Article 8 OST. The USA must make sure that SpaceX's activity do not cause interference with activities of other state parties.
And in March 2018, the Federal Communications Commission, an independent agency of the US government responsible for inter alia communications by satellite, granted SpaceX's application requesting authority for part of its satellite system. But what if they collide with another space object or cause harm falling down to the Earth?
Yes, this is about the principle of liability for space activities. Article 7 OST assigns international liability to the launching state.
Exactly. The Liability Convention lays down a regime of twofold liability. We differentiate between absolute and fault-based liability.
According to Article 2 of the Convention, the launching state shall be absolutely liable to pay compensation if its space object caused damage on the surface of the Earth or to aircraft in flight. This means that in case of a damage, this damage is attributable to the launching state just by proving that it has been caused by a space object of the state and regardless of fault or intention. In contrast, Article 3 of the Convention regulates that a launching state is liable for damage caused by one of its space objects elsewhere than on the surface of the Earth, only if the damage is due to its fault or the fault of persons from whom it is responsible.
Which means non-governmental entities such as SpaceX are clearly included here.
All right, let's quickly put on record that, principally, SpaceX as a private entity is allowed to peacefully use outer space in accordance with the provisions of the OST, as it is authorized to do so by the USA. In cases of any damage caused by Starlink satellite, for example, the USA would also be liable for the company's activities.
All right, but is SpaceX allowed to place as many satellites in the orbits as they like? Wouldn't the outer space be overpopulated probably one day?
This, in fact, would be very risky, as we will see later. At this point, what we know is that any national territorial appropriation in outer space is prohibited. But any permanent use of orbital slots, meaning a permanent occupation of areas in outer space, could also fall under the non-appropriation principle.
I think this discussion is a good point to involve our two guests, Professor Hobe and Dr. Franziska Knurr. Franziska, actually an international relations alumna, has worked at the German Aerospace Center in the space management sector for 3 years now and is responsible for UN matters.
Professor Hobe is, amongst many other engagements, director of the Institute for Air Law, Space Law and Cyber Law at the University of Cologne. Welcome and thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Good morning to you too, and thanks for having me.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
So would you say that placing large numbers of satellites in the low Earth orbit is legal, or could it be characterized as a de facto appropriation maybe?
I don't see how this legal argument really works, because every satellite to some extent appropriates for a certain time, a certain orbit, and avoids others to use this certain place. But of course, with those increasing great numbers, this is an issue we can definitely talk about. More interestingly, I think, is a look at Article 9 of the Outer Space Treaty, which provides that state parties shall conduct their outer space activities with due regard to the space activities of all other treaty members.
But could it not be questionable whether the SpaceX activities are in the province of all mankind, as stated in the OST?
I think that's a very, very good point that you're making here, but we have one problem. As you say, Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty is written in a way that is difficult to grasp concretely. What is the province of all mankind? Admittedly, these are important formulas, but it's kind of broad. In case this would go to the court, would have perhaps different ways of interpretation. Or at least an authority that allows the launch would have this margin of appreciation, whether it says, well, this is against or is for the province of all mankind. I have great doubts whether the law that you have designated as hard law is really so hard.
All right. The due regard principle you've mentioned before, Franziska, is, we should tell our listeners, also important concerning the protection of the outer space environment. It is, together with the cooperation principle, included in Article 9 OST, but sanction mechanisms in case of non-adherence are lacking. So these provisions establish rather a spirit of protection than a concrete legal mechanism imposing specific enforceable legal obligations on states. And this is where we get to the problem of space debris.
Exactly. At first sight, it might not be evident why Starlink has a lot to do with it. But in order to achieve its goal of providing high-speed internet all over the world, Starlink plans to install a total number of 42,000 satellites in the orbit.
Which is 5 times the number of all satellites launched between 1957, that was Sputnik, and 2019.
Correct. This is why there are some concerns that SpaceX's futuristic fantasies might not only clutter the beauty of the night sky, but also lead to a huge amount of space debris.
Space debris is, as you have confirmed, Professor Hobe, the practically most important and legally very challenging problem for current space activities. According to UN Copious, space debris is defined as all man-made objects, including fragments and elements thereof, in Earth orbit or re-entering the atmosphere, that are non-functional.
You might think that some garbage should not be a major problem in such a vast area like outer space. It kind of sounds like throwing a chewing gum into the ocean, but it actually is. Currently, there are millions of pieces of space debris that are flying around the orbit nearly 7 times faster than a bullet. They can damage and even destroy satellites and spacecraft. As you know, our modern way of life highly depends on satellites. Just think about navigation, communication, or the weather. Also, if space objects survive Earth's atmospheric re-entry, there is the danger of damaging property or even a person on Earth. Furthermore, there's a scientific scenario that could make space activities totally impossible in the future, the so-called Kessler syndrome.
This scenario suggests that once past a certain number of objects in the orbit, the total amount of space debris will keep on increasing because the objects collide with one another. These collisions give rise to more debris and lead to more collisions and a chain reaction.
Even if we do not have legally binding regulations concerning space debris so far, Jörn Kopjus has endorsed the Space Debris Mitigation Guidelines in 2007. These voluntary guidelines are supposed to increase mutual understanding on acceptable activities in space and thus enhance stability in space-related matters and decrease the likelihood of friction and conflict.
What role do these guidelines play in the international context? Are they implemented?
Of course, they are non-binding in a legal term, but we see that many states adopt them and make them binding on their national space actors. However, we see that they are not implemented as much as they should be.
As you have just stated, Franziska, some states have harmonized their legislation with the guidelines, such as the US, where the debris mitigation standard practices are quite similar to these guidelines. We have already clarified that SpaceX needs to get a license from the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, to be able to launch in the US. But still, what if space debris caused by Starlink satellites harms another state's space objects?
In general, as we have explained before, the US is basically responsible for SpaceX's activities and would have to compensate for possible damage according to the OST and the Liability Convention.
Right, but in order to establish liability, there are some difficulties. First of all, the Liability Convention might not be applicable for space debris because it is not clear whether space debris is captured by the definition of space objects. In fact, the UN Kopjus definition we already know is not legally binding. The question of whether pieces of space object, when fragmented and scattered due to a collision, are still part of the original space object has not yet been answered.
If there is a collision by, as you mentioned, a Starlink satellite and a non-functional object, then the Liability Convention would apply if appropriate states have ratified it. And then it says that the launching state of the space object is liable for the damage created by this object if there's fault for this activity or for this damage. And here we really have troubles because we don't have traffic rules. And it will be very difficult to establish the extent of fault. And this is a problem that we have not yet solved. But I don't have a clear solution or an answer for you because we don't have any legislation and we don't know of any cases that have been solved or settled, except the one case you might have heard of.
You surely mean the case from 1979 when a non-functional piece of a Soviet satellite was considered to be a space object when it crashed into Canada. The Soviet Union had to pay a fee of $3 million Canadian to Canada for causing damage to its territory.
But that was rather the result of diplomatic negotiations than legal interpretation. However, even if space debris fell under the definition of the Liability Convention, other difficulties could occur. At first, there's a problem of attribution. It would be necessary to identify the debris which caused the damage and trace it back to the launching state of the originally launched object. Most of the time, it is hard or even impossible to determine the launching state.
Right. But apart from the attribution, the crucial question is the one of fault.
Franziska and Professor Hove, would you say that there's a lack of mandatory international standards regarding debris mitigation to establish a, so to say, standard of care to be able to actually assess the fault?
This would be a very tricky undertaking by the settlement body that would be someday required to assess these questions. And it would depend on its willingness to also consider non-legally binding standards.
Very, very, very good, very complicated question. Of course, we have a standard in general international law. That would be the due diligence standard. What has an entrepreneur to do in order to hinder collisions, for example? These would be, I think, clear-cut obligations that would determine of what a satellite, what a user had to do that would go into the big portfolio of due diligence. So I think this is absolutely nonsense, this rule that we have in Article 3 of the Liability Convention, because we cannot, this is of no help, this default principle that we have there.
And even if liability was given and compensation, etc., was insured, that would not really solve the problem of increasing space debris and the potential threat of the Kessler syndrome. We are, according to ESA, already at a point where debris mitigation is not enough.
So an active space removal program is needed, basically something like a vacuum cleaner in space.
That would be great, yes. In the past years, voices demanding a legal framework for so-called space debris remediation as a tool for sustainability in outer space have grown louder. But here we have another legal problem. As we know, a launching state has jurisdiction and control over its registered objects and their components, irrespective of their function or size. Another state, or a private entity of another state, is not allowed to touch, interfere, or to remove a space object without the launching state's consent.
Otherwise, the state which removes the space object would break the law and be liable under the Liability Convention.
However, bearing in mind that it has not been conclusively clarified if space debris falls under the definition of a space object, would it not be, at this point of time, legal to remove space debris?
This is exactly the reason why I would say that also space debris is a space object. The very notion that every space object, even if it's not functional anymore, is a space object of some state. If it's registered, then the state retains jurisdiction and control over this object. And this is a really important and key notion of international space law, which we should not throw easily overboard, because this is actually a fundamental rule that creates trust and predictability between states acting in outer space.
What do you think, Professor Hober?
Very disputed. I'm absolutely of the opinion that a piece of space debris is a space object. I see it from the perspective of the Liability Convention. We have the other problem, you know. Can we intervene without the actual permission of the owner? There, I a bit differ from what the major opinion says, because I think going into general German administrative law, we have situations where a thing can cause danger to something else. And regardless of whether it is in my possession or not, if there is the danger, you must act in order to hinder something worse. So weighing the two threats, threat to property, and threat to having an accident or threat to nature.
But although it is disputed whether you can legally remove space debris, there are already different initiatives like the ESA to clean up space.
Well, they are planning to remove their own satellite. But still, if you follow this rule that you can only remove something with the permission of the responsible state, these technologies are kind of tricky.
Yes, there are several concerns around this technology. It could also be used for surveillance activities or even more aggressive purposes. These mechanisms require detailed technical information concerning the object, which is why debris removal operations might impact intellectual property and confidentiality.
Accordingly, once there are objects, such as our Starlink satellites, already put in place in the orbit, it is hardly possible to remove them afterwards.
Exactly. This is why some claim that it would be necessary to stop the deployment of satellites. For example, a group of scientists from the Astronomical Observatory of Trieste in Italy suggested to bring the case to the International Court of Justice. They argue that the night sky is a shared human right under the World Heritage Convention. The satellites SpaceX is deploying have created bright streaks in some telescope images, harming astronomical observations. Have you heard about this discussion, and what is your opinion on it, Franziska?
Oh, I would love to see a case going to the International Court of Justice, because we have not had any space-related jurisdiction and jurisprudence by the International Court of Justice. So this would be interesting to see what kind of interests and legitimate objectives need to be in the balance when we approve these large satellite constellations.
And what about the argument that the sky is common heritage of all mankind?
Similar arguments have been brought up with regard to space mining or mining on the moon. If you look up to the moon and see huge man-made craters because someone is mining there for resources, is this something that is acceptable to our society? But I would say that other objectives might be similar valid. So this is a very interesting discussion that, as I said, cannot only be solved by legal arguments, but necessitates somehow a societal dialogue, I would say.
Yes, we definitely agree. Let me just relate this to a research question. We can see that even though the sheer activeness of SpaceX in space could be considered legal, whether its activities are legitimate remains an open discussion. In the end, we, the society of the states using outer space, must ask ourselves, what is more important to humankind, cheap internet and fast communication, or the night sky? The exploitation of our technological capabilities, or the possibility for future generations to discover faraway galaxies?
Sure, until this point, our listeners might not have the feeling that there has been so much motivation to cooperate in the air so far, especially among the states.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think right now we are at a point in time where member states tend to focus on their freedom of activities. However, I think it's mere factual necessity to increasingly coordinate and discuss with others.
In this very nice interview, we have discussed the problem of can we afford launching 42,000 satellites? This is exactly, I think, the same point. Our international space law must become sensitive to other interests of other users and of the very nature of outer space. I think then we go in a safe future, and that's what we must fight for.
Oh yes, this brings us to the conclusion that in the end, the international civil society and state community have to weigh the different interests, their importance and value, and especially should not forget about those who cannot represent their interests today because they have not yet been born. Future jurisprudence could also help in this balancing in the context of established legal principles to coordinate and contain space freedoms.
And it also remains to be seen how non-binding provisions, such as the space debris mitigation guidelines, would or could be incorporated here. To ensure that existing legal loopholes or grey areas are not exploited, the international community needs to further develop the existing treaty law. I think the recent political, technical, economic, and environmental developments illustrated before are pointing us in a concrete direction. We will have to find compromises
in order to avoid the same mistakes as on Earth. We need cooperation, a fruitful international discourse, and to walk the talk.
Apropos talking, we hope that our podcast will help to stimulate at least the societal exchange about the future of outer space, and maybe it has even brought you a little closer to the stars.
This was today's episode of Public International Law in a Nutshell, the CIS podcast series.
Thank you for listening. We hope to have you with us next time again. Stay safe.